Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. Monumental battle. The Biden administration expands national monuments at the center of debate over cultural heritage and national resources. Then, the Trump effect. Prominent Republicans embrace the former president on the campaign trail with an eye toward the midterm elections. And race matters. We explore the efforts underway to address violence and systemic issues in one of America's toughest cities.
We believe in imagining something radically new.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. The drug maker Merck formally asked the FDA today to grant emergency authorization for its antiviral pill to treat COVID-19. The company reported that the medication cut hospitalizations and deaths by 50% in mild to moderate COVID cases. Approval could take weeks, but if cleared, it would be the first COVID treatment in pill form. Southwest Airlines is working to restore operations after canceling some 2,000 flights since Friday. The airline blamed the disruption on air traffic control issues and severe weather. Tens of thousands of passengers were left stranded over the holiday weekend, waiting in long lines as they struggled to rebook flights.
My concern is we had no explanation really that was, I feel, very legitimate or believable. And the weather and the traffic controllers, I don't think, were the real issue. And so we're frustrated. I'm missing a day of work. I own my own business, and I'm canceling appointments. So it's kind of frustrating.
The Federal Aviation Administration questioned Southwest's explanation since it was the only airline to experience major cancellations and delays over the weekend. Both Southwest and the pilots' union denied reports of a sick out to protest the airline's COVID vaccine requirement for employees. The central U.S. is recovering today from a band of severe weather that left thousands of people without power. Tornadoes and baseball-sized hail struck parts of Oklahoma overnight, damaging homes and buildings, but sparing lives. The same storm system also brought heavy rain and strong winds to Arkansas, Kansas, Missouri, and Texas. In Southern California, Huntington Beach reopened its waters today, just over a week after an oil spill from an offshore pipeline contaminated the shoreline. Surfers returned to state and local beaches after test results showed no detectable amounts of oil-associated toxins in the ocean. Preliminary results a day after Iraq's parliamentary elections showed a record low voter turnout, suggesting widespread distrust in the vote. The bloc led by Shiite populist cleric Muqtada al-Sadr held a solid early lead. The election was held months ahead of schedule to appease anti-government protesters who were calling for change. But many were still disappointed with the outcome.
We are about to have the same members of parliament, the same bloc in control, the same sectarianism, and the same approach. So that is why the new government will not deliver anything new.
There was no immediate word when the final results would be announced. Iraq's prime minister announced today that his country's security forces captured one of the Islamic State's top leaders in a cross-border operation. Sami Jassim oversaw the group's finances and served as the deputy leader of ISIS under Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who was killed in a U.S.-led raid in 2019. Three U.S.-based economists will share this year's Nobel Prize for Economics. Canadian David Card of the University of California, Berkeley, was honored for his research into how the minimum wage, immigration, and education impact the labor market. Israeli-American Joshua Angrist of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Dutch-born Guido Imbens of Stanford University were recognized for finding alternate ways to study economic issues. Stocks tumbled on Wall Street today as investors awaited this week's company earnings reports. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 250 points to close at 34,496. The Nasdaq fell 93 points and the S&P 500 shed 30. Still to come on the NewsHour, Amy Walter and Tamara Keith discuss former President Donald Trump's continued hold on the GOP. How a historic Northern California town plans to rebuild in the aftermath of one of the state's largest fires. One woman's brief but spectacular take on surviving breast cancer, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
The Biden administration recently restored three national monuments just ahead of Indigenous Peoples Day. They include the Northeast Canyons and Seamount's Marine National Monument, as well as Utah's Grand Staircase Escalante and Bear's Ears. The White House said the move protects land sacred to Native Americans and preserves cultural and scientific wonders. William Brangham has our report.
Back in 2017, the Trump administration reduced the size of the Bear's Ears National Monument by 85% and cut Grand Staircase Escalante's size in half. Both of those are in Utah. Those moves were supported by ranchers and Republicans who have long pushed to open the monuments for mining, development, and drilling. The Biden administration has been working for months to undo those moves and just announced them on Friday. Joining me now is Nick Martin. He's the editor of the Indigenous Affairs Desk at High Country News. He is also a member of the Saucony Tribe in North Carolina. Nick Martin, great to have you on the NewsHour. As I mentioned, the Biden administration has been working on this for quite a while, but they announce it right up on the edge of Indigenous Peoples Day. Help us understand, is that timing significant or not?
I think it's more of a happy accident, let's call it. I think it's something that very clearly going into the Biden administration, I think tribal leaders had expressed in terms of our national goals of Indian country, kind of immediate needs of change. Bear's Ears, the Bear's Ears reduction was a major one. And then there were, I think, obviously with Keystone XL kind of being the other, I think, major action point that we've seen so far. So, you know, definitely on the part of tribal leaders, I know they would have loved to seen it happen day one or two. But yeah, I do think everybody's quite happy the way it turned out. But also just in general, you know, that happened on Indigenous Peoples Day. We'll call it a happy accident in the optimist version and, a wonderful public policy play on this ladder.
For people who don't know what these locations are like and what these places are like, can you just give us a sense of what they are like physically and why they have particular resonance for Indigenous peoples?
Well, I think both in terms of what they hold many things. And so that can mean something as complex as spiritual, important, sacred sites that hold a certain religious importance to the Pueblos, to the Ute, the Paiute, the Navajo, Hopi. Those are obviously going to be something that generates a lot of emotional connection point, and subsequently is going to be where you try to leverage your political power as well. But also, I mean, I had an opportunity to speak with former chairwoman of the Ute Mountain Ute tribe, Regina Lopez White Skunk, on Friday, and she broke it down even, I think, on simpler terms for me. This is where her grandmother grew up. This is where her grandmother was taken away from to go to boarding school. And when she escaped boarding school, she walked all the way back to the area around Bear's Ears because that's where their ancestors had been for thousands of years. It's something as simple as a familial connection, but that familial connection is undergirded by thousands of years of ancestral connection to this place. So that can mean the bones of your grandmother and your ancestors. And it's also a place that holds lots of historical knowledge in terms of the petroglyphs and the way that these areas have been, they show, I think, kind of that Indigenous ingenuity that has persisted throughout time since we've been here for time immemorial. And it feels like something that protecting that was obviously always going to be a major priority for the tribal nations of that region.
As I mentioned before, the Trump administration undid what the Obama administration has done. Now the Biden administration has undone what the Trump administration did. Given that the tenuous nature of that, plus the long history of treaties being signed and then violated by the U.S., is today considered a victory, or is this still considered a sort of fleeting thing that could disappear in a few years' time?
I think both of those things. We can celebrate the fact that this was an administration recognizing and acting upon its nation-to-nation relationship it held with the tribal nations of this region. At the same time, I think we can not, I think, be cynical, but be realist in the sense that if a Republican takes the White House in 2024, then what effectively we've done is played a game of ping pong for 16 years. We want policies in place that will hold regardless of who's in office at a given time.
Virtually all the Republican leadership in Utah, from the governor on down through its congressional delegation, have condemned this move. What is it that they don't like about it, and do they have the power to undo this?
I think in the short term, no. It is something that this executive action that Biden took is going to hold through at least the end of this current term. The major reason for kind of upset is kind of as you said at the top of this segment, which is that this is an instance where you have folks who are a little bit more pro-development and very much would prefer to see the land put towards ranching, put towards mining and drilling and resource extraction and development, opposed to something more of this wider protection area that just creates a lot more kind of hurdles and boundaries for those things to be able to come to fruition. So in the short term, no, but obviously, again, if this is something that is just going to be an executive at the executive level and not the legislative level, then yes, I think within the next 6 to 8 years, you could actually see this just go back to the Trump era cuts.
All right. Nick Martin of High Country News, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
It was his first political rally in Iowa as a former president. But Donald Trump spent much of this weekend's visit spreading a false message, sowing doubt unjustifiably once again about last year's presidential election. And as Yamiche Alcindor reports, some of the state's most prominent Republicans were by his side.
Donald Trump in Iowa. It's a familiar sight from past campaigns. But this time, he coupled grievances against Democrats with yet more lies about the 2020 election that he lost.
They rigged the election, and now, based on the rigged election, they're destroying our country. This is about the American people having their country taken away from them. That's what it's really about.
Present for these latest claims were some of Iowa's highest-profile GOP elected officials. There was Governor Kim Reynolds.
Senator Chuck Grassley has my complete and total endorsement for re-election.
And Chuck Grassley, the longest-serving Republican in the Senate. Last month, he announced he's seeking an eighth term in office.
It seemed to me...
Earlier this year, when the Senate put former President Trump on trial for inciting the January 6th Capitol attack, Grassley voted to acquit him. But in a February statement about the riot, Grassley sharply criticized the former president. At the time, Grassley wrote of President Trump, quote, "The reality is he lost. He encouraged his own loyal vice president, Mike Pence, to take extraordinary and unconstitutional actions during the Electoral College count. President Trump's language was extreme, aggressive, and irresponsible." This weekend, though, at the Des Moines rally, Grassley enthusiastically accepted Trump's support for re-election.
If I didn't accept the endorsement of a person that's got 91% of the Republican voters in Iowa, I wouldn't be too smart. I'm smart enough to accept that endorsement.
President Trump still enjoys robust support from rank-and-file Republicans nationally as well. A survey last month from the Pew Research Center found that two-thirds of Republicans and Republican-leaning independents still want the former president to remain a major figure in our politics. And just under half want him to run for president again. In recent months, he's tried to exert his influence over policy debates, last week even chastising Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell for agreeing with Democrats to delay a clash over the federal debt ceiling. But on the topic of the 2020 election, the number two House Republican, Steve Scalise, repeatedly sidestepped a question this weekend about the legitimacy of the vote.
I understand you think there were irregularities and things that need to be fixed. Do you think the election was stolen? Yeah.
And it's not just deregulated. It's states that did not follow the laws set, which the Constitution says they're supposed to follow.
That drew a quick response from Congresswoman Liz Cheney, one of the few vocal critics in the GOP of the former president's false election claims. She said of Scalise's TV appearance, quote, "Perpetuating the big lie is an attack on the core of our constitutional republic." The former president is openly supporting a primary challenger who is trying to unseat Cheney in next year's midterms. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Yamiche Alcindor.
And that brings us to Politics Monday. I'm here with Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR. She joins us tonight from Dayton, Ohio. Hello to both of you, Tam in Dayton and Amy Walter right here in the studio. Amy, let's just pick up where Yamiche's reporting stopped. What does it say about that Senator Chuck Grassley, longest serving Republican in the Senate, who back in February said that President Trump was irresponsible, and I'm quoting here, encouraged his own vice president to take unconstitutional actions, now in October is happy to have his endorsement?
Yeah. Well, he gave you the answer. I wouldn't say no to somebody who has a 91% approval rating among Republicans in this state. Donald Trump easily won the state of Iowa, even as polls at the very end of the 2020 campaign showed that maybe it was going to be a lot closer. The Senate race that year, also polls showed it being very close, ended up not being close at all. So he knows exactly what he needs to do to win the nomination. And that's where so much of this energy that we're seeing on the Republican side is coming from, is that primary base, right? People who will show up, go to conventions, go to primaries. If you are a Republican and you're running right now and you have other Republicans in a primary running against you, you cannot afford to not be with the president.
Tam, what about that? Can any Republican who wants to be reelected stand up to former President Trump right now?
There are very few of them out there that exist. So I guess if Liz Cheney is able to win her primary, then maybe that will be one case. But the reality is that this is Donald Trump's party. And as he continues to lie about the outcome of the election, to spread misinformation about irregularities that have already been debunked, the reason that so many Republicans believe what he says is, one, they'll believe almost anything that he says, his true supporters, but because there are so many members of his party around him who are either willing to look past it, try to sort of talk around it, as Steve Scalise did, or gladly accept his endorsement. So I do think, though, that these midterms will be a test. The former president has endorsed a lot of candidates. He's going to continue to endorse more. The question will be whether his candidates come out ahead, and also whether, if they lose, they accept that they lost.
And Amy, you were telling us today that when you look at the Republican voters who identify as Republican, not all of them say they want him to run again.
Right. That was the poll that Yamiche was referencing in that setup piece. Yeah, 60-some percent of Republicans say, we like that Donald Trump's part of our, you know, he's the public face of the party. We want him to stay involved in the party. A lot of them want him to run, but only 44% said, I definitely want him to be the nominee. But that's today, right? They know, I think a lot of these voters know what a general election could look like with a very, maybe it might be a close outcome. Maybe they believe the election last time was rigged, but that the president lost by 7 million votes, right? So it is something of a risk to put up a president who never hit 50% in terms of job approval ratings to put up to run once again. At the same time, you say, well, who's going to beat Donald Trump in a primary? Who's going to run against Donald Trump in a primary? Who could raise that kind of money, and who could withstand the Donald Trump sort of bulldozer effect like he had in the 2016 election?
So many voices weighing in on this right now. Tam, you spoke, I guess, in the last few days with Stephanie Grisham, who was the press secretary at the White House for a time. She's written a book.
Yes, she was the press secretary for about 9 months, the press secretary who many Americans may not even recognize because she never once held a briefing. And she was incredibly loyal to Trump and to First Lady Melania Trump. And now she has written this book. And part of what she said in our interview is that she is genuinely concerned both about 2024, if Trump, if he runs and wins. She says that, you know, there were a lot of things that he wanted to do where he was held back because, well, he had to run for re-election and you had to worry about what voters would think. Well, she says if he wins in 2024, what's to hold him back? There's no running for re-election. And she has her eyes also on 2022 and just how many of his loyalists can be put into Congress or into secretaries of state roles and others. Though, of course, we have to say that the second she turned on Trump, Trump and all of Trumpism turned on her. So she's a person in exile who doesn't really have a huge audience necessarily because, I mean, people who support Trump don't like her anymore and liberals already hated her.
But she is out there talking and making the point, making those points.
That's why she wrote the book, she said.
Yeah, that you're just sharing. Meanwhile, Amy, we're looking at other polls around that have to do with President Biden, and he's slipping. He's sliding.
Yeah, he's struggling right now, and we started to see it over the summer as the Delta variant was taking its toll. And then, of course, the pullout in Afghanistan and the chaos that ensued there. And now, of course, divisions within his own party. This is not unusual for a first-term president, right? They go through this tough time. You get a little bit of a honeymoon, reality sinks in, expectations are not met, and then you have a sort of a tough slog. And the question is, where can you be by this time next year? Where the party needs him to be, but by this time next year, is at least at 50% approval rating. Right now, he's somewhere around 44, 45%. So it's not dramatic, the jump that he needs to make, but he needs to start improving. A lot of it will rest with how well is the economy? How well are we at? What I think is happening is the sense of voters feeling frustrated that we're not back to so-called normal yet. That whatever normal was to you after COVID, right? That I hear this so much from voters and focus groups, the sense of, I thought things would be better by now. And whether that means I thought he would be able to do more on the things that were important to me, or I thought by now this COVID thing would be behind us. We wouldn't be yelling about masks and mandates. I wouldn't still be waiting for the products that I'm ordering and shipping backlogs, and that things are still costing a lot of money.
And Tam, you are there, as we said, in Dayton, Ohio. Have you had a chance yet to hear what voters are saying about the president?
Well, I am still getting my feet on the ground here, but I will say that what I'm looking into in my reporting is the American Rescue Plan. That thing passed back in the spring when President Biden was still in that honeymoon period. It's this huge COVID relief legislation that a lot of people have forgotten about already because Biden and Democrats have moved on to the infrastructure proposal and the Build Back Better plan and these other things that they're pushing to try to pass and sort of struggling to pass. Meanwhile, this massive infusion of cash, much of it hasn't actually hit yet. Some of it has, but a lot of it hasn't yet. And the political question is whether Biden and his party will get credit for it, or whether by design, having the money sort of roll out slowly in some places, whether it is designed for sort of maximum impact, but minimum political credit.
Well, we will be looking for your reporting and asking you all about it in days to come. Tamara Keith, Amy Walter, thank you both.
You're welcome.
For more than 2 months straight this summer, the Dixie wildfire ravaged Northern California. It burned close to 1 million acres before firefighters were able to put out the flames. And one small historic town was nearly destroyed in its wake. Special correspondent Kat Wise traveled to Greenville in Plumas County for a closer look at what remains after the Dixie fire.
I really wanted to see what was in here.
In the ash-strewn lot where her home once stood, Pam Courtright finds a precious talisman.
Look at it. It survived.
Every charred possession she uncovers from the debris tells a story.
That's funny. I see a beer stein from Germany. Look at.
The home where their family made a lifetime of memories is just one of many that was leveled in a matter of minutes by the ferocious Dixie Fire, the second largest in California's history. The fire destroyed about three quarters of all of the buildings in the small mountain town of Greenville.
You can't even tell. I had a little pond out here.
Courtright remembers rushing home from her office just before the fire reached her doorstep on August 4th.
I literally packed up my stuff and said, I'm leaving, my house is going to burn down. Even though we didn't think it would happen, we were ready, so yeah. So we left out of town and it was pretty much on both sides of the highway.
The hillside ahead of us was basically 100-foot flames coming down.
Chad Herman is the undersheriff of Plumas County, which includes Greenville.
There were spot fires occurring everywhere, and it just incinerated the town in a matter of 30 minutes.
Nearly all of the town's residents evacuated, and no lives were lost. But this is the scene they came back to.
I went through roughly at 7 o'clock at night, and it was extremely smoky. There was still active fire burning, but it was devastating knowing what this town used to be.
Oh, there's the bed.
Robert Deschler and his wife, Michelle, were returning to take in the destruction for the first time.
Oh, honey.
The loss was overwhelming.
We've been coming up here 40 years.
Yeah, we've been coming up here for 40 years.
It's not the first home they've lost to fire.
In 2017, we lost our home in Fountain Grove in Santa Rosa, so that was pretty devastating. We moved to Skyhawk, and a year ago, I think there was like 15 homes that burnt 300 feet from us, so we almost lost that house. This is going to choke me up a little bit, so.
Greenville was a tight-knit community before the fire. Residents took pride in the many historic buildings here that dated back to the Gold Rush era. Now those buildings are gone, and residents are scattered around the area, staying with friends and family and in RVs as winter approaches.
So you guys can know.
At 9:30 in the morning, Kevin Goss would normally be opening the local pharmacy that stood in the center of town.
This building, the Village Drug, was the oldest building in town, or at least one of them, and the weigh station across the street. 1800s, Gold Rush town, it's got a lot of history. We did unfortunately lose a lot of history, and we're gonna try and save everything that we possibly can.
As the fire tore down this hillside toward Greenville, Goss rushed in to save the pharmacy's computer and the health records of all his patients.
We bought that in 1988, a family-owned business, and it really was heartbreaking, truly heartbreaking.
The town's main street stands silent and largely deserted, save for inspection and cleanup crews. But even now, Goss is greeted warmly by the few who remain.
Yes, the pharmacy is near and dear to me, but this whole community is near and dear to me, and that's what really broke me. Not just this. It's the whole thing as a whole, everything as a whole. All the people that came into the drugstore over the years, all the people that I knew.
Goss also serves on the Plumas County Board of Supervisors. He says many in this working class community didn't have the safety net of insurance. And even families that did, like Pam and Andy Courtright, are worried about the future.
And I guarantee you, we had really good insurance before. We won't. We won't next time. More than likely. Nobody in this community will have good insurance. We'll have to do the California Fair Plan. So, and I don't know how exactly it works, but it's very difficult to pay that bill.
Right there where your hand is.
The state of California has issued a moratorium that will prevent insurers from dropping homeowners in wildfire-scorched areas over the next year. And the California Fair Plan is supposed to ensure that all homeowners, including high-risk ones, have some basic fire insurance. But barriers remain.
Insurance is always a problem. Homeowners insurance and some of these folks could not afford the higher rates that these insurance companies are having to charge to insure these homes.
It's only the beginning of a long process of cleaning up, but Kevin Goss says that so far they've gotten the help they needed because this small town sits at a crucial waterway.
They're actually moving at a pace that is urgent, as we are the headwaters to the Feather River that feeds Oroville, which is one of the main water sources for the state of California. So this debris, they do not want to go into that water system.
These green wattles are supposed to keep that debris from contaminating the water system. Still, Chad Herman says the aftermath of a wildfire in a rural community like Greenville is a far different picture than when fire strikes wealthier California enclaves.
When you look at the fires that they had down in Sonoma, you have an infrastructure with a fantastic money base between the wineries and industry. In the rural mountain communities, you don't have that. We're not a rich county. So when you have a group of people who have very little to begin with and they lose everything, it makes it very difficult to come back from that. And we still have people without adequate housing. So we have people that are still in tents and travel trailers.
Kevin Goss is hopeful that the town he's known all his life will rise again with better firewise planning and more resilient construction materials to prevent the town from burning again.
Some folks, the trauma is going to be too much for them to come back. It's permanently seared in their brain and they don't want to go through that again. Folks like myself and others are going to say, hey, you know what? We're going to build this thing back to where it can survive a fire like this. Most folks want to come back to their home. I mean, even though it looks like this, it's still their home. It's their piece of property. It's their where they grew up or, you know, where they've had all these memories.
Pam and Andy Courtright don't know what they'll do next. For now, they're living in an RV on a friend's property. And the memories of the home they lost feel more real than a future without it.
I literally walk through my house inch by inch. You know what I mean? When I lay down at night,
mm-hmm.
Every square inch I walk through.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Kat Wise in Greenville, California.
A.Q. Khan, the father of Pakistan's atomic bomb and a proponent of nuclear proliferation, died on Sunday after a lengthy battle with COVID-19. He was a controversial figure known for launching Pakistan's nuclear weapons program and for admitting to sharing nuclear technology secrets with some of America's adversaries, including Iran, Libya, and North Korea. Nick Schifrin has our report.
He was once one of the world's most dangerous men, shunned even by his own government. But this weekend, he was hailed a hero. On Sunday, Pakistan hosted a state funeral for Dr. Abdul Qadir Khan, known as A.Q. Khan, who helped create Pakistan's nuclear weapons program and the Muslim world's first nuclear bomb.
Yesterday, a great man died. He was a great scientist. He served this country. He served this country with emotion, dignity, respect, and with hard work.
In the 70s, Khan was a metallurgist working for European companies that designed centrifuges, equipment that can create nuclear fuel. By then, Pakistan had lost a portion of its territory when Bangladesh became independent. By 1974, India tested its first nuclear device. Khan started stealing centrifuge designs for the Pakistani military. By 1998, they were ready. He and Pakistan's leaders tested their first nuclear weapon. For Pakistan, he had helped assure the country's survival. Just days before, India had tested its own nuclear devices.
A.Q. Khan was acting as a patriot as he saw himself.
Rolf Mowat Larsen is a senior fellow at the Harvard Belfer Center. In the early 2000s, he ran the Weapons of Mass Destruction Unit in the CIA's Counterterrorism Center. That's when A.Q. Khan's other legacy became public.
A Pakistani arms merchant of death, some have called him, to enable other rogue states that wanted to follow Pakistan's secret path. The unique aspect of A.Q. Khan's network was first how sophisticated it was. He had unique contacts, unique sources, unique supply chain that I don't think we had ever seen in any other proliferation network.
Iran's program started as a virtual copy of Pakistan's program. North Korea already had a plutonium program, but Khan provided a second path to the bomb through uranium enrichment. And Libya's Muammar Gaddafi, who gave up Khan's network and the centrifuges bought from Khan after the invasion of Iraq.
A.Q. Khan seemed to be willing to sell to the highest bidder, but with one obvious exception, which is what you were so focused on, right, Al-Qaeda?
We had information that nuclear scientists in Pakistan were in contact with Al-Qaeda. We ended up finding several sources that it looked like Al-Qaeda had never benefited from any assistance from the AQ Khan network.
But the U.S. confronted Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf about Khan's proliferation, and Musharraf confronted Khan. Khan went on TV to say he'd gone rogue.
There was never, ever any kind of authorization for these activities by the government.
Do you believe the Pakistani military knew and endorsed what he was doing?
The scale, the number of years he went about doing this activity, it's hard to believe, first, that he could get away with it without people having knowledge of what he was doing, and second, that he wouldn't have had at least the confidence that he had the endorsement of the Pakistani government to some level.
Today in a statement, Khan's family said his lasting regret was that he was never officially exonerated from the accusations leveled against him by the government of Pakistan. For the last 15 years, Khan was prevented from engaging with the world prevented from engaging with him, which means he died from COVID at 85 years old, likely carrying some of his secrets to the grave. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
Of all the cities with surging murder rates last year, Chicago was among the worst. Homicides were up 56% from the year before. But there are efforts underway to address systemic issues that feed the violence there. Award-winning rapper Common and his pastor, the Reverend Otis Moss III of Chicago's historic Trinity United Church of Christ, discussed some of their ideas for change recently with Stephanie Tsai as part of a larger program produced by the Peace Studio, a nonprofit that supports artists and activists, in partnership with the WNET initiative Exploring Hate. The conversation is part of our Race Matters series.
There again has been another summer of gun violence and homicides in Chicago. Bring me there. What is happening?
Anytime you talk about violence or economics, it always starts spiritually, because economics and actions of violence are spiritually connected. And Chicago, especially where we live, has not had the investment, I mean, in these communities. I mean, you're looking at spaces in the city that when African Americans migrated from Mississippi and Arkansas, all of a sudden you had these incredibly gifted people, and the powers that be saw them as a threat and pulled back the investment for social control.
There was literally discriminatory policies put in cities like Chicago keep people of color down, and you see the legacy of that today.
Absolutely. Matter of fact, even the police department was utilized by the city of Chicago specifically for social control. People were policed one way in one community and policed another way. So one community got public health and public safety, and another community got repression. And that was our community. And so we believe in imagination. Your new song, talking about imagine. Your new song, Imagine. We believe in imagining something radically new.
Talk about that song and how it relates to what Reverend Moss is saying.
I grew up on the south side of Chicago. I was not poor, I was not rich. My mother's an educator. My stepfather's a plumber. We were in a middle class home. But in my neighborhood, there was gang culture. I could have been on the wrong path. But what was it that allowed me to see myself as valuable and work towards that and like dream and think about things? Well, one is for surely God and spirituality. Another is my mother making sure that that was reinforced in her love and showing me that, hey, these are opportunities that you can seek out and have. And I bring that up because it was at a young age that I was imagining doing something and becoming something. And I think, you know, I don't have the one solution to the violence. And many times, you know, we get asked, like, what is it? And I do believe it is, on a deeper level, it is a lack of the spiritual, like, connection where you do. Because anytime, even in the most difficult situations, if I see the God in another human being, I'm not going to look to destroy them. And I think that's, you know, one of the keys to us, like, healing our city.
Your music has always put into context the violence that's current in Chicago. And I just want to, I won't be able to wrap this. Maybe you can. But from, I hope I don't put these lyrics, these beautiful lyrics to shame and these searing lyrics from Black America. Now we slave to the blocks. On them we spray shots, leaving our own to lay in a box. Black mothers' stomachs stay in a knot. We kill each other. It's part of the plot.
Yes.
Part of the plot. What did you mean?
Well, what I meant from that is that America, when it comes to Black life, has never allowed Black life to have, like, its presence where it's like, oh, a human being that can have, like, great education, health, even pursuit for themselves. Like, if you think of the foundation of America, I mean, we were enslaved. Our people were enslaved and dehumanized. And that has been the mentality that has been passed on generation through generation. We still got Jim Crow laws and we still got mass incarceration. And now the plot has been to say, man, we are in fear of the equality and rise of Black people. So we're going to figure out ways to make sure that they don't come up. We're gonna push you down. And we'll do it indirectly, we'll do it subconsciously, we'll do it directly by shooting you in the streets. And until people who are leading the country, like, say, man, that plot is no longer acceptable, that mentality won't be healed, as we said. The right word is healed, because it's wounds on Black people and in the country.
I'm trying to put myself in the shoes of a Black kid living in a pocket of violence in Chicago that seems inexorable. Mm-hmm. And I'm feeling that I would feel anger, and I wonder, how do you speak to that?
I think the first thing is that you have to tell them the truth, that we fail in America so often to speak the truth about what people experience. So as a young African-American male or young African-American female, you have people who sugarcoat or lie to you about what you experience and see every single day. We need truth tellers, you know, the art of what Common is doing. He is a truth teller. And scripture says the truth will set you free. The other piece is that we no longer can frame Black life solely as tragic. There are tragic moments, tragic experience, but we have such depth of spirit to always rise above the tragic. That's why we write the blues. But the blues is not about necessarily hanging my head. It means that I'm experiencing something existential, but at the same time, I see something powerful in the future. That's what happens with the Black experience.
And I hear two things from what you're saying, all in all, if I could sum up. It's you're focused on the practical,
yeah,
and the spiritual.
Yes.
It's both and. You know, jobs stops bullets. Education will prevent prison, and love creates community.
Reverend Otis Moss and Common, thank you so much.
Today, October 11th, is the International Day of the Girl. And tonight we hear from one girl, a young Afghan poet, who left her country a few years ago with her family for security reasons. Ariane Ashori now lives in Germany in a refugee settlement. She shared her thoughts and writing with the NewsHour Student Reporting Labs as part of our arts and culture series, Canvas.
Writing poem, it makes me to feel free and to empty my pains and my stress that all hide in my body. I just take my pen, I took my notebook, and I try to write something down thinking about issues about, like, for example, about what's happening in my country or what's happening to me right now. Don't kick us like a ball. Try to be one of us for a day. Try to understand us. We are not a game for you, that when you get tired, you can leave us. Try to feel us. We are tired of this much moving from place to place. Try to be one of us for a day. I'm sure you cannot understand how our days are nighting. I'm sure you cannot accept to see your children held back from education and playing with the garbage all around. I know you cannot. I know you cannot be one of us, even for an hour. Me, as a refugee girl, personally, I see my soul like a 35 years old. I'm not old, but this stress of living in a country makes me old. Our destination is a question mark. I just wish that no one's life should be a question mark. I just wish and wish that no one's life should be carried in her backpack all around. I'm not different, but I am a refugee. I'm not a terrorist, but I'm just forced to be in your country, forced to leave my beautiful homeland. I could say my biggest hope is to see my families living in one place, not to just move around. It's really damaged our mental health. If we do not live in center in specific place, we are like always carrying our life on our backpack from place to another place. So it's very difficult for all of us. And it's one of my hopes for future, to have a specific place to live inside.
After receiving a breast cancer diagnosis, healthcare journalist Kate Pickard began conducting extensive research to become more informed about her own treatment. Her book, Radical: The Science, Culture, and History of Breast Cancer in America, chronicles her findings and her personal story. Tonight, during this Breast Cancer Awareness Month, she offers her brief but spectacular perspective on surviving breast cancer.
Strangely, the day after my cancer diagnosis, I had a job interview that had been previously scheduled. And I remember saying to my husband, I don't think there's any point in going to this job interview today. And he said, why? And I said, well, I'm going to die. Why would I go to this job interview? And he said, well, maybe you won't die. So I went to the job interview and I nailed it. And I think it was because I felt so incredibly alive. When I was diagnosed with breast cancer, it came as a total surprise. I was 35 years old. I was the mother to a 3-year-old daughter, and my husband and I had recently moved to California. I think that because I was a healthcare reporter and I was always writing about other people, this work made me feel sort of invincible. The period of getting my diagnosis was the most stressful period in my life. It sort of felt like the worst case scenario kept coming true. I was constantly aware of my daughter's presence and was staring at her all the time. And as difficult as a treatment for breast cancer is, it was nothing really compared to the sort of mental toll that first month of diagnosis took on my family and me. When I would tell people that I was diagnosed with cancer, a lot of people really have a strong urge to relate. And they would tell me a story about someone they knew that had had cancer that had passed away. And when I talk to other people who have been recently diagnosed, I try to be a good listener. I try to also acknowledge how much it stinks. I think the only thing that really calmed me down was understanding my disease and understanding my treatment. Having the science explained to me, reading the studies myself, because that gave me faith that the treatment would work. The other thing I learned very quickly after my diagnosis was how much I had misunderstood breast cancer. For all the awareness and all of the pink ribbons, there are so many things that most people know nothing about when it comes to breast cancer. For example, breast cancer isn't even really one disease. It's a collection of different diseases. They have different prognoses. They're treated differently. Our understanding of breast cancer was really like, it was like frozen in 1995. It created this understanding that was true then but is no longer true now. I would say within like 2 weeks of my diagnosis, I knew I was going to write something big about this. There are parts of the book that are about me personally, and those parts I really had to report out, just like I would be reporting on another person, which I think was both helpful mentally for myself, and I hope allowed me to also write a pretty honest account of what it's like to be a breast cancer patient in the modern age. My own story with breast cancer, I hope, has ended. I finished my treatment in February 2016, and I have not seen any signs of my cancer's recurrence or continued existence since then. I'm sort of hesitant to call myself a cancer survivor because we really never know if that's true. Breast cancer for myself is something I think about all the time, although less and less every day, thankfully. My name is Kate Pickert, and this is my brief but spectacular take on breast cancer.
Kate Pickert, thank you so much for sharing your story. And you can find all of our brief but spectacular stories at pbs.org/newshour/brief. Tomorrow night here on PBS, we explore what is behind the lack of affordable child care in the U.S.
Child care in America. For many, it's out of reach.
I don't know what we're going to do. I can't find daycare.
Often scarce and costly.
I kept saying to myself, it's got to be a better way.
A dilemma that sparked a national debate.
Access to quality, affordable child care.
We can't have everything.
And will impact Americans for generations to come. Raising the Future, the Child Care Crisis, a PBS NewsHour special report Tuesday, October 12th at 10, 9 Central.
And on the NewsHour online, Americans of the Sikh faith have lived in the United States for more than 125 years. But since 9/11, the community has fought for understanding and fair treatment while advocating for peace and compassion toward others. You can find out more about how this effort is going on pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.